வரலாம்.
We're waiting on all the candidates. They are all on the same flight. And they should be arriving any minute now. But Alma is suggesting that in their absence, if we could process these minutes, there's a whole lot of minutes that we've got to approve. And apparently the House Chairperson is of the view that this committee has not submitted a single minute to him of a record of its proceedings. So can we quickly just peruse these minutes? Alma has been, I think, quite thorough in capturing all that we've discussed. And this goes back to early this year. So there's a whole set of them there. There's three of them, am I right? Okay. Can I give you 5 minutes just to quickly glance through them, and if that's acceptable, we can then approve the minutes. The first one is the 16th of February, 23rd of February, and the 24th of February.
The minutes that are in front of me and where I was present, it's a true reflection of what happened. Except that on the minutes of the date here, 23rd February, where I am registered here as absent, I was present. For the fact that I remember everything that happened, and I was part of that. Thank you.
No, it might be that you were present and you remember. It could also be that you got a vision and you were informed about these things. There could be other means by which the information could be delivered to you. So,
listen, I'm sorry, but I really think I wouldn't have added the situation of that parliamentary studio on my speech if I wasn't.
Okay. All right, can I have a proposal for the adoption of the minutes? Van den Berg. All right, well, that's a very important correction. Okay. Proposed by Nikki, seconded. Nobody wants to? Let's look at the language. Thank you very much. So this minister approved. while we're waiting, if we can have an informal discussion, we're just looking at the law. And maybe the lawyers can help us here. This issue on the disqualification, just get it here. Disqualification. This is not a formal decision discussion, it's an informal discussion. If you look at that clause 6, a person may not be appointed as a councillor if he or she, okay, and then if you look at F and G, has a direct business interest. Am I getting it right there? Is it the correct clause? That person may not be appointed. Now, in law, what does that mean? What does it actually mean? Because I think the issue is a person comes here, gets interviewed, the person says that I have a vested interest, but I don't know if I'm going to be appointed. But I'm declaring to you that I have a vested interest. Should I be appointed, I will dispose of my interest. Now it goes to the House, it goes to the Minister, and then the House appoints the person. So let's say that person gets appointed. Now at that point, he or she starts the process of disposing of assets or whatever it is. But the law says a person may not be appointed at all. which that person has got an interest. Now, the legal people are just saying that, look, what do we understand as a committee by that? Because it's lucky. You remember that he did declare. And I raised it in the last meeting, and he says that he's got a, well, I've seen his press, his response to the media queries on this matter, and he says he's got a period of 6 months within which to dispose of his assets. And then there was the issue for what his date of appointment, and he says his date of appointment, I think, was 15th of November or something like that. So he has up to now, 2 days from now, to sort this matter out. But there's nothing in the law that tells him 6 months. Where does that 6 month arrangement come from? Does it come from the Nikasa understanding? Where does the 6 month come from? I thought we might just want to apply our minds and think about this issue, because it's a question we're going to have to put to everybody here. Are there any interests? Should you be appointed? How will you deal with it, etc.? It's going to be quite an important question. Advocate Delanga, have you got some bright ideas to help this simple-minded people with complex issues of law?
Well, I've just received it. The problem is the disqualification seems to be absolute, in the sense that the Parliament may not appoint a person who has those interests. The problem, of course, is what happens now when they have. I mean, there's no clause that provides for that, because they assume that Parliament wouldn't make that mistake. I imagine the law. So, I don't know where one will go from here, because it seems to me that the appointment was illegal from the beginning. But, you know, I would like to look at it a bit more. I've just received it literally a minute ago. But it does seem to me problematic.
Can I just appeal to members of the media? This is an informal discussion. Please don't report on this. We are trying to understand the law. So I don't want a big headline to come that says Parliament has made an illegal appointment or something. We're trying to get legal clarity on the matter. Please, Mr. Vajjato and SABC, and I don't film this, please.
Well, it's maybe a bit late now that they've recorded this stuff. But no, I really think we'll have to probably obtain outside legal advice, because it's Parliament that's involved and this committee that's involved, and I think it's very important that we receive outside advice. I have no doubt at all that the appointment couldn't take place. The big problem now is, what can we do about it? If Parliament has acted in a way that the law does not permit it, that person has been in a position, clearly been part of decision making, and now to rectify it. I imagine him disposing of his interests rather rapidly would help somewhat to ameliorate the problem. But the problem is, we'll have to find out from counsel whether the appointment has any legality, in the sense that from the outset, we weren't allowed to make the appointment, and what the consequences of that is, and thirdly, what it is that one does now to either rectify it, or do we have to redo that appointment? I think those are the questions that we need someone to do proper legal study on.
Mr. Baloyi is delaying us quite a bit. If you see on the list of the program, he was supposed to have been the first candidate. He was due to fly last night because he was the first candidate. He missed his flight yesterday. We booked a hotel for him. We don't know whether he slept in that hotel or not. Now, this morning, he was on the flight with everybody else. And when he landed at the airport here, all the other four candidates were in the combi with the driver. Mr. Baloyi disappeared for 40 minutes. He claimed that he was in the bathroom. I suppose normal nervousness for the interview. It does trigger some stomach problems. So I one of the first questions we might want to ask him is, Mr. Beloy, do you understand punctuality procedures, etc.? I mean, because he's really holding us. He should have been here at 9:30 this morning, because he was booked last night. I mean, at our cost, actually. There's a correspondence we've received from Dr. Ellison Gilwell, which has been circulated now. So this correspondence from Dr. Gilwell, she is formally withdrawing from the process, not because of any intimidation on the part of Mr. Nicky van der Berg, but she says that you're a good friend of mine, but I mean, the letter simply says that there's been a domestic crisis and she will not be able to continue with this process. So that's why she is not in the program for today. If you remember, we had shortlisted her for this the round of interviews, but she has withdrawn from the process completely. So I thought it's important to put that on the record because it's part of the proceedings. The second thing is that there's also been correspondence from the minister to Mr. Sisulu, the speaker, in which he says that he's notifying the speaker of three further vacancies that are going to become open or available in Inkatha, and he's urging Parliament to commence with the nomination process and the interview process as soon as possible. I've had a brief discussion with the minister on Thursday, and he is, he emphasized very strongly he would be comfortable if this committee can proceed with the nominations process after this round, as soon as possible, in terms of our program. So I thought I just needed to put that on the record as well. You know, originally we were planning to do this in the next quarter, and I think the committee needs to just consider the notification from his side. So that's the second letter which I'd like to table. And then the third matter is that our discussion that we were having earlier on, can we formally pass a resolution that we're going to ask for outside legal advice on this Section 6 and the disqualification, particularly in relation to the last appointment, because I think that's really what it might have a bearing on that, but also for clarity for the committee as to what needs to be done, etc. Advocate De Lange has pointed out there's a clause 6.2, am I right? In the Act, which does allow for a mechanism to avoid the situation that we've had now with Mr. Stuckey. But that process has to unfold up to the point where the minister makes a formal appointment. Maybe he'd like to just talk to us about that so that we all understand the issue.
Now, I think it's the way we summarize it, Chair. This book always confuses me where to find these things. Clause 6.2 is basically what we discussed. The exact wording is a person who is subject to a disqualification contemplated in subsection 1B to I may be nominated for appointment as a councillor, but may only be appointed if at the time of such appointment he or she is no longer subject to that disqualification. So clearly the people that drafted the legislation saw their problem, and they then set out a way of how dealing it. And what they're saying to us is, if you fall under B to I, so in other words, A, L, K, J, K, L, you can't even nominate, you can't do hearings. But B to I, you can nominate, you can clearly do hearings, but the clause then specifically says that before you appoint such a person, you must make sure that the disqualification no longer exists. And as you can see, there's no time frame attached. So it's literally before you sign the appointment and make the appointment, there must be assurance that that disqualification doesn't exist anymore. That makes a lot of sense to do it that way, and that's how the legislation stands. We just didn't see subclause 2. So I think that makes it clear for us how to deal with this matter.
Any further clarity at this time? Okay. So I think, the committee would still like independent advice on this matter. It might be good to have a legal opinion in writing before the committee, which we can then take forward once we get it, decide how we want to process it then. Edward De Lange?
I also support Mr. Lill's suggestion that we get one person from the ANC, one person from opposition to sit and draft the questionnaire application form for us, similar to the JSC, because that will help us a lot in when people are applying. They can still attach their CV, but then the questions we need to cover in the legislation, we can cover in such a questionnaire. So I would support her suggestion on that.
We should ask questions like, are you a South African citizen? Have you been convicted of? And you say yes, no, something like that. So, okay, that's a sensible suggestion. All right, so can we, Ms. Tony? So, for example, the question was, do you have any financial interest in this particular sector? If the person says yes, then we know when we're doing the interview if that's an area that we might want to focus on. Yeah, so it will help us, actually. All right, so there's a suggestion that two people from this committee actually try and draft something for us. Can I have two volunteers? Ms. Delil and Advocate De Lange. You know, there's an old rule which says if you suggest something, you get nominated to do the work. I mean, you can't do the work. All right. No, Langa is busy with exams over the next 2 weeks. He's got. I've seen his exam schedule. He's quite busy. So it will be Advocate De Lange and Patricia. If you can draft something for us, or prepare, design something for us, and then we can always use it as a, what's it called, a pro form? Yeah, model affair. Okay. Template. Thank you very much. Is Mr. Norman Baloyi here? Please call the gentleman in. Mr. Baloyi, good morning. My name is Ismail Vadi. Welcome to the Portfolio Committee on Communications. Before you are members of the committee, they're from different political parties. You are here for the interview process, so please make yourself comfortable, feel at ease. What we're going to ask you to do is perhaps just take us through your CV for a few minutes. You've got quite an impressive CV. Just talk us through that for about 5 or 10, not more than 10 minutes. And then members would put questions to you based on the information you've provided. I assume that you've read the legislation, the relevant legislation, so there might be questions relating to that. And we don't think the interview will be more than 35, 40 minutes. So over to you then. There's a button there. I just press the button there.
Okay, greetings. I want to greet everyone this morning. Okay, my name is Norman Tinyoko Baloyi. I actually started my primary and tertiary qualifications some years back, where I started with I sit in and grew up in Olifantsburg, which is Limpopo village. I did my standard 10 there. Then I went to VET in 1993, to do my BSc in mathematics and applied mathematics. And then I also did my honors in computational applied mathematics, which was industrial mathematics specialization. And I also did some postgraduate studies in telecommunications, which was Masters in Science at University of Cape Town. and another master's with the University of Pretoria in electronics, and another master's in business and administration at UKZN, and other certificates, higher diplomas and postgraduate diplomas in management. So my work life has been so much interesting in the sense that I did a lot of work in different areas, such as research. I started with CSIR, where I spent 6 years working as an electronic engineer, who were actually conducting research where we developed systems for the Department of Defense. So our focus was mainly on the systems development, project management, and the development of systems which were in radar systems and communication systems. And then I went to National Intelligence Agency, where I was working as a senior IT security advisor. I was advising government departments. My main clients were housing departments. All housing departments were my clients, and also the financial institutions of government. So my role has been on the advisory role to advise government in how best they can secure their systems and what are the best state of the art that they can follow. And also assisting them in the implementation of those systems that we are considering them as best practice in the industry. And then I went to the Department of Finance and Economic Development, where my role was working as a senior manager of financial systems, where the major role there was to develop the ERP system for government, which was a new initiative by the province of Limpopo. And the system was meant to be deployed to national and provincial departments if successful. So before the full implementation of the system, there was a moratorium from National Treasury that there must not be a major development of financial system, because they were intending to start a system from scratch. So I went to electronic communication and security, in electronic communication security called COMSEC, which is an initiative of NIA, where I was in the ICT department, the core business of COMSEC, where our role was to develop and implement systems which are secure, electronic communication systems, which are secure for government use. And then I went to CETA, State Information Technology, where I worked as a general manager of research and development, where I was using ICTs as a key enablement to government service delivery, where we did develop some good systems for government, which were also piloted, and two of the systems, they were rated finalists and semi-finalists at CAPEM. CAPEM is a Commonwealth Association which actually deals with government initiatives and rates the systems and programs that were developed for government, whether you are being innovative in your system development. So I was glad that two of the systems were rated second finalists, and were rated finalists and semi-finalist positions. And then I worked for Chemical Industry CETA, which is one of the CETAs, 23 CETAs, based in Johannesburg, where I worked as a chief operations officer, and now I'm with International Business Research. So my role has been more in the IT side and strategic management. but also in electronic communications when I was with the CSIR, and also ComSec, where I was working in electronic communication systems. So that's why I feel privileged to have been part of these interviews, because it's an opportunity where I will deploy all my skills that I have acquired across all my lifetime, and I'm very much relevant for this position because I also worked for regulatory institutions. So I feel confident that I will make great impact into how best we can take ICASA to the next level.
Thank you very much. Emmis, you've gone through the CV. Mr. Arlo is here. Nikki?
Thank you, Chairperson. If I must, may ask, sir, what do you think is wrong in ICASA, and how will you fix it?
I cannot say it is wrong, actually. What I can say is that ICASA is instituted in such a way that it is somehow unique in South Africa, where we see the council members being executives. It's a unique situation which is less appreciated by industry players, because it's not how they operate to have council as executives. But the good part of it is that the clarity of roles between council and the management is somehow defined in the Act. So that is something that maybe needs to be implemented with some skill of understanding, so that there is no overlap of who's supposed to do what and who's not supposed to do what, so that we engage ourselves in developing the industry to the next level. So what is also unique within ICASA is the way that it is regulating so many industries at in one point. I mean, regulating the telecommunications sector, broadcasting sector, and also the postal sector. So it's quite a challenging task, and that comes with some uniqueness. So the issue of the problem, I think it can be the question of the independence, where it's always in the news how independent they are, because they are in between government and industry. So all these parties, government and industry, there's always some form of conflict of interest, because there's always the need to bypass some of the regulations, and there's some elements of wanting to get your voice heard. And the independence is always questioned in most times. So I cannot say that it is something which is not happening within ICASA. I can just say that the independence of it is always being questioned, because they are playing the role of, they're in between, they're playing the role where they have to regulate all the sectors from the government point of view and also from the industry point of view. So it's something that I think the next chairperson of ICASA has to be strong on. I mean, something which is important is to make sure that that independence is seen by everyone, that there is fairness, there is openness, there is transparency, and there is freedom of expression at all times.
Are you 36 years old this year?
Yes.
We hesitate, sir. I don't think that would be the difficult question.
No, I'm trying to figure out what is the point after this.
Now, you should leave that to me. Don't worry. Now, I wanted to say, reading through your CV, to find a young man of 36 with so many talents and expertise and qualifications is very rare, so I think we should congratulate you with your diligence. I just looked, there were many years that it seemed you were just studying and studying and studying, and that's most impressive.
Well, thanks very much for the compliment.
Now comes the tough question. You'll see under areas of expertise, you basically mentioned everything in human existence there except law, which is not a bad thing, not mentioning law. But it worries me when I look at all those expertise that one becomes a jack of all trades and a master of none. What I wanted you to explain to us so I can understand more clearly who you are is, what would you regard are you the master of in those areas of expertise?
Okay. Through my entire life, what I was having the approach of doing each and everything that I do with all might and all strength, and master whatever I do, because there's no need of having interest on something and you don't master it. So my point of approach was that I must do each and everything to the best of my ability, so that I'm more fluent in each and every area, so that I talk each and everything from the point of experience and extensive experience. So I believe that I have acquired all the mastering of all those areas.
Now, I have no doubt of that, but that's not what I'm worried about. What I'm worried about is, what is your passion and what is it that you want to make your life mission out of those areas of expertise? Because clearly with your huge expertise and so on, everyone was wanting your skills. I'm trying to find out, are we going to be able to hold you in ICASA? Is it worth investing in you in ICASA? Will you be staying there, or will you be moving on with all these expertise you have? What can we expect? Will you commit yourself to?
Okay, my commitment, if you can see from my day one of work experience, my expertise has always been information and communication technology. Each and every area where I've worked, that has always been my key role and my passionate role. So, I'm a person who has been hands-on in those experiences of ICTs, and I'm a person who is still passionate about it, and I've actually gone through the stages of strategic leadership in that area of ICTs. So my investment in acquiring those experiences and knowledge was mainly to enhance the service delivery of our country. So I'm a person who has been and always will be the ICT person. So ICASA provides that expertise that will be enhanced through my existence within ICASA. So I'm a person who wants to be in a regulatory environment, because I've realized that I can make contribution in the ICTs and also these other areas of broadcasting and telecommunications and process. So I'm worth investing in. I'm a person who is going to be staying for the full term if I get appointed. And I'm a person who is having that type of hope that things will always get better in my presence.
So if we appoint you, you're going to commit yourself to a CASA for the full term. You're not going to move on to other...
No, definitely. If you can see my first employment with the CSR, I stayed for 6 years there because I was passionate about research and electronic and IT type of work that I was doing. So being part of this, I'm in CASA, I believe that I'm going to be contributing a lot and staying the full time without any disturbance and without any interference.
Members of ICASA play an important role in terms of the characteristics they have: integrity, honesty, punctuality. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Punctuality as well?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to explain to us why you didn't come here till last night?
Okay. You know, I would want to explain what happened yesterday. You know, I arrived at the airport, Polokwane Airport. It was, I think it was 23 past 5. And we were allocated that the departure would be 25 past. The boarding pass. The boarding time started at 20 past. And then there was only one person who was waiting there. And this person rushed to, the airport outside there to ask for the permission whether she can still take some people. So, and she stayed there for around 10 minutes, and I could not believe it. And I realized that it's because she's working alone there. And she's doing this up and down, and because they don't even have the phone inside where they are waiting, where they're checking in people then. So when she came back, she said, "You're already late." And I said, "But I've been waiting here before the time of the closing time arrived." And then she said, "I can book you for 9 o'clock." And then I had to drive to Joburg and arrived there at 8:30. So it was not actually my fault. It was the question of service delivery within the airport that contributed to the whole inconvenience. And I'm so sorry about that.
All right. It's something that worries me, but I'm not going to take more time today. I would have expected you to be there earlier. You've held up a meeting today because you were our first person. That's why we flew you down last night. But let's leave it at that. Lastly, I want to ask you, you know, the thing about ICASA is there's huge pressure on the members of ICASA, even if those members don't know how much. But the industry clearly puts huge pressure on. Probably politically there's pressure to get things done and get moving with things. Everything depends on you. Tell me, what are your characteristics as a person that's going to be able to handle those pressures and still deliver on your responsibilities without being unduly influenced by either of those forces?
Okay. You know, when I take my life back and see how much I had to deal with and the pressure at work and the pressure of my studies, I can tell you that I work both sides with the distinction. I am a person who is able to take pressure no matter what it takes. I make sure that what needs to be done gets done effectively and efficiently. I remember when I was a senior manager of financial systems in Polokwane. You know, the development of the financial system that I was dealing with, it was having around 11 people, as you, no, 11 departments as users of that system. And there were always pressures every day because the system was new and it was not so easy to deal with each and every part of the task that I was assigned to. But through some good systems that we developed, the systems where people can also assist you in delivering their service to the department, people who were contracted, people who were staffed by the department, I had to make sure that the systems are in place so that they can work independently and also interdependently, so that each and every work that needs to be done is being done and carried out effective and efficient. So my role within this organization of ICASA will be to put in place those type of systems that will not demand only one person to deal with them, but a situation which will make each and every employee or each and every member who is contributing to the delivery of ICASA's mandate to have that space and time to provide that leadership and service that needs to be rendered by those individuals. So I will make sure that each and every member is somehow accountable to the actions, being able and given the space to carry out what needs to be done. Their responsibility has to be somehow carried out effectively. So my role will be more of providing those systems and those systems, policies, and the procedures to be available for each and every member to assist me in carrying out the mandate, because I'll be more into the overall leadership of the organization. So I will have to make sure that each and every task is being implemented successfully. So I'm a person who takes pressure. I always make sure that each and every task that I do has got some form of quality and is being appreciated by the role players. So having been in the industry where I have been so much pressurized and gave good reports, good results, I believe that through the leadership of assisting the counselors and also the management of the organization to carry out their functions, I'm able to do that, and they will somehow be accountable for their performance as well, because there will be some failures, that there will be some performance management system that will have to be signed and to be implemented by each and every member of the staff.
You haven't said anything about conflicts of interest, but let me directly ask you.
The conflict of interest?
Yeah. Do you have any shares, you or your family have any shares in the communication industry, or any business interest in the communication industry, or in any partnerships in the industry with others in the whole communication industry?
No, I don't have any.
Okay, thank you. Master.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
You spoke about the independence of the regulator vis-a-vis the industry. And I'm just wondering if you can elaborate more on your understanding of the independence of the regulator now in terms of the powers that are invested to the minister in policy making, and also your independence if you happen to be appointed, of ICASA, the independence of ICASA, in dealing with the parliamentary committee that has the responsibility of oversight over the industry and the entities that are within communication. What do you understand about the independence? Is there any way where you think the regulator would be loggerheads with the minister? And can you just elaborate on what you are speaking about? And I heard all the questions that were asked by Honorable Dulanyi. But from my experience dealing with the ICASA, most of the councillors that exit in ICASA happen to have interest in the industry. I wonder if you would go the same route when you exit. And we wonder why is that so. Maybe you have an insight on what attracts them so much. Thank you.
Okay, let me start with the last one. I think, in my mind, what attracts them will be the association and the inside information that they have about the industry, and they somehow gain some more interest in how best they can utilize their existing skills that they developed while they were in ICASA to further their personal interests. So I think the association that is there with the industry somehow have some influence in their future endeavor. So, but from my point of view, from my personal approach, I'm a person who know what I want in life, and I make sure that I don't get easily influenced. I don't get easily influenced by outside circumstances. So I value my approaches to life. Mm-hmm. More than any other outside circumstances. So in relation to the independence of ICASA, I believe the independence comes with some form of accountability. Because what ICASA is expected to be is that they must be a watchdog or to be somehow neutral, to take all the points of view from both sides of conflicting parties. So the key role will be on the judgment side, where we want to see fairness when we are having two sides of the story from two parties that are somehow competing or want to win something or want to get their views to be the ones that is being taken. So the major part will be on the judgment side, whether you do show that independence, whether you are so much fair in your doings. And having the act in place and also having some form of researchers within ICASA, I believe that the judgment that is being taken for or against one party will be something which is well researched, something which is one of the best practices that the people can all see that if you are having this type of situations, then this is an automatic choice of an answer that any reasonable person can have. So I can also put some points on the freedom of expression, because ICASA has to show some form of expression
The freedom of expression, where they also put in place the consultative process in all key areas that need to be looked at when decision making has to be made. So I believe that through that process of consulting, the independence also come into play, because you give all people the chance to participate and engage in those key areas of decision making, and then you decide the final output. So transparency and openness are also key roles in independence part, because we have to open doors and communicate our intentions, our strategies, our approaches and our dealings to each and every member who is interested. So we have to be somehow be more transparent in our doings at all times, so that we are able to cater for each and every interested party and we don't exclude them. So in relation to the minister's involvement in policy making and also the portfolio committee issues, I believe that it is important for the chairperson of ICASA to be a person who will take the relationship between all the key stakeholders seriously. So the relationship building, the relationship establishment, and also the maintenance of that relationship is very much critical. I expect that this person will have to account to the portfolio committee. And somehow there has to be a best way of making sure that the relationship between the chairperson and the castle is well established in a mature way, so that we are not at loggerheads for this and this, this and this at all times, but we work together in the building up of the better ICASA with the portfolio committee. And also the relationship between the chairperson and the minister. Obviously, the chairperson also accounts to the Minister of Communications. So there's some elements of how best do we engage each other and how best do we satisfy each other's needs, so that we look at the minister as a political figure who is there to give the strategic direction of what is going to be happening in terms of policy development. Whereas ICASA will have to develop their own policies in relation to what the political direction is taking us to. So I believe that the good relationship is also critical between the minister and ICASA chairperson, and also to look at how best we can always work together for the delivery of our services to all key stakeholders there. Fisher?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Mr. Roy.
Afternoon.
I just want to find out, have you read the ICASA Amendment Act?
Yes, I have read it.
Now in the Act, there are a number of reasons why a person can be disqualified. And if you had read through all of the possible things that can disqualify you, is there anything hear that you need to say to us will disqualify you?
At the moment.
In terms of the act?
No, I'm fully compliant.
You're fully compliant?
Yes.
With all of the points?
Yes, I am, yes.
And I'd like to know, what kind of sports do you do? You seem to be a very serious person, studying all the time.
No, I'm not. I just, not for the wife. No, actually, I'm a person who likes sports. If you can look at my CV, I ever won volleyball award at the University of Cape Town. So I'm a person who likes sports a lot, including South African sports.
Yeah.
All of them.
Also, just under your employment history, could you just elaborate further when you, I think it's say 21, when you were with the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, where it refers to duties through KPA, speaker identification, 18% improvement of a 5-year world record of the world leader in speaker identification with Professor D. Reynolds at the University of Massachusetts. What does that involve? What does it mean? Because you also say that a new world record was set in South Africa.
Okay.
Just explain to us that.
What I was trying to say there is that I was engaged in this project called Speaker Identification System. This system is actually a telecommunication type of system where it identifies the voice of the person who is speaking. It's a voice recognition system. So it gives you the correct rate that no man now is the one who's talking. That's the one who's talking, you know, this type of thing. So it was a database of 630 people that were all recorded and in the database. And the system has to be built to actually recognize who among the 630 people is talking.
Oh.
Yeah. So it could be used for many different reasons. In police, they can use it. Investigations, they can use it. Telecommunications, they can use it. So in the quiet environment, the system is 100%. But in a noise environment, where there's some elements of noise from outside, the system performance is lower. So by the time that I was developing that system, the performance rate was 61% in a noise environment, but in a quiet environment was 100%, and we're more challenged with how do we deal with noise so that noise doesn't become a problem whenever we are identifying who is speaking. So my role was to enhance the system's performance in a noise environment. And this challenge was a challenge which many people didn't take for 5 years, because I believe it's because the standard was set by Professor Reynolds at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is recognized as the best university in the world in technology. So my role was to challenge that recognition rate in a noise environment, to build a system which would be better than that one at MIT. So, and I managed to beat that record by implementing a system which was 18% more better.
Okay, well done.
Thank you very much.
The last one, Chairperson, is that you also mentioned that at one stage you assist one department, a government department, to secure electronic communication systems. Is it possible in this day and age to have a 100% secure system?
No, it's not possible these days, because there's always ways of between systems. There are always new technologies, there are always new developments. So people who can always hack to your systems are the ones that are also trying to sequester. So they find loopholes of getting around it. So there's no 100% sequester system. It's impossible, and it'll never be possible.
Thanks, Chair. Good afternoon. Only a few questions. Thanks very much. No, in your CV, I think I will join other members that your CV is a very good CV, and you're coming from Limpopo. I'm trying to match this CV in the Limpopo. But thanks very much.
No, you can hear.
No, but thanks, because I think two members have asked this question, the question of business interest, whether direct or indirect, and your answer was emphatic no. Thanks for that. Currently, we are working as an executive director, but when is that contract is expiring? Because you said that contract will expire very soon. So when is that expiring? But also, what do you think your contribution will be in ICASA, taking into cognizance your previous experience? It does not also so much relate to industry regulating, but it's most of your experience is setting up systems that prevent corruption in the companies and things like that. It's not a record, it's not regulating, but what your contribution will be, and I can see also, there's one thing that I don't understand, but maybe you'll assist me. If you think that question is not fair, please advise me. Sometimes ago you were working for NIA, and you were seconded to finance and economic development. I don't understand that, seconded. And also your task and duties in the other department was not related to the task that you were doing at NIA. I think there's one that I also want to understand that. While also you're working as a senior IT security advisor, one of your clients was ICASA. Yeah, can you elaborate that, how you and how that relation will assist you to understand ICASA better nowadays? Thank you.
Okay. Let me start with your last question. When I was working for National Intelligence Agency, I was given a list of clients that I had to look after. So my main clients, as I said earlier, were all government departments in Gauteng and also financial institutions of government. And ICASA and NNR were some of my clients. So what I was dealing with them was actually on the advisory, to advise them on best IT security standards and systems and technologies. So, and also assist them to implement those systems and technologies that we recommend. So it was more of an advisory role. So, and also to check the state of their IT systems, whether they have got governance issues, and also the capacity to carry out their responsibilities in the IT department. So, and then the other part was that I was more with financial institutions of government. So, and they were the ones that were more interesting because their systems were a little bit better. That's why I ended up going to the Department of Finance to assist them with the development of financial systems. So it was a role that was enjoyable.
Because when that period of implementing that system came to an end, I went back to NIA in the form of electronic communication security. That company, which I said that is a private company owned by NIA, but it has been legislated. It came out of a Comsec Act. So it started actually in 2003, and I joined them in 2004 in January to take over from the existing ones. They actually merged the other functions of the existing ones, which were in the apartheid time. So you also asked me about the composition in ICAS. Okay. My contribution in the cast was, as I think I've mentioned earlier, that it was mainly on the advisory role on the IT best practices. I was actually assisting them with finding best ways of dealing with IT standards and best practices. I don't know if maybe you want to reflect them.
Sure. No, my question was that in terms of your experience, you were setting up security-related equipment rather than regulating the industry.
Okay.
And I was asking, with your previous experience, what your contribution you think will be in the ICASA based on your previous experience and the new task that.
Okay. Okay, thanks very much for that clarity. I believe that my experience from being strategic to regulatory will have an immediate impact in ICASA because, for example, I worked for Chemical Industry Center where we were actually setting up standards and policies for training institutions. And then 2 weeks I was with Umalus, for example, where we were assisting them with the evaluation of the SET colleges. And I'm also part of NRF, National Research Foundation, the TRIP program, which deals with the funding of small companies, which have got some elements of need in the development of the ICT technologies. So they have to somehow partner with some tertiary institutions. So, and we have to evaluate their needs of the project's finances and also the evaluation of the progress that they are making and assist them in the development of and the commercialization of those systems. So in relation to ICASA, for example, my advantage will be to take the experience that I've gained through this related type of experience that I've gained to make ICASA the best institution to work for. To be more attractive to the industry players in ICTs, broadcasting and postal. I mean, what I mean is that I realized, for example, that the performance management system within ICASA is still in an infant stage. So it's something that needs to be developed much more, so that it will be able to give some good rewards to best performing people who are working in ICASA. So I believe that I have got the startup type of experience that will
make Ikhalsat to be a better place in relation to my experience. I believe that I can make a contribution from day one of being the counselor there, and also giving it a new direction or a better direction. Because I'm a person who have set up standards, who have set up processes, who have set up systems, and also a person who has got some type of political mind in approaching my work efficiently, so that I understand where the end result would be before I start engaging in something.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? Stola, I just got one or two questions. This morning, all of you came on the flight together. You held up the whole delegation for 40 minutes. Where were you? I said this morning, when you landed at the airport, all of you came together, but you held up the delegation for 40 minutes before you could come to Parliament. Where were you all the time?
No, it's not actually like that.
Okay.
What happened is that at when we arrived, I went straight to the bathroom, and then I got a call from Tembe, because I think it was around... We landed at exactly 10 past... No, at exactly 10 o'clock. And then when I came out of the bathroom, I got a call from Tembe, and then I said, I'm inside the building, and I'm going to check these people out there. And then immediately when I went out, I didn't see these people around. And then I called him, and then he said they just left. And then they will come back for me. And thereafter, I waited for them. Then they came back. They said, no, we didn't. The time that they were about to go, they were told that I'm still around. So it was around... It took a space of around 10 to 15 minutes when I was waiting for them. So, but it was not because of other things. It was because I went to the bathroom, and then I hoped that they were going to be around there within 5 minutes, and I would be able to join them.
Thank you very much. Thanks. I think we'll be over with this interview. Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. No, I wanted to say thanks for everything, for accommodating and for flexibility, and also for being part of this process. I feel much privileged. And I believe that everything will be fine.
Thank you very much. All right. Can we get the next person in? Members, there's some sandwiches there for you. We are not going to break. So just grab something now, and then you can. We will proceed, because we are now struggling with time. I'm going to ask you to just quickly talk us through your CV for 5 minutes or so, and then thereafter members would pose questions to you, which you would answer to the best of your ability, and we're hoping the interview will be about 35 minutes or so. So over to you then.
Good day, honorable members of parliament. Thank you for affording me this opportunity. My name is Lahlang Felix Fomo, born and raised in Limpopo, Mokopane, historically called Peter's school day, and then I went to study at the University of the North. That's how I obtained both my degrees, BProc and LLB. Then I went on to do my articles at Edward Nathan and Fritz, and then it was called. Now it's Edward Nathan and Sonnenberg. Then I got admitted as an attorney. And then I picked on telecommunications as a niche to focus on. Then I got appointed as a manager legal affairs by SATRA then, the telecommunications regulator, which has now merged with IBA to form ICASA. I was there for 2 years, and then I got an opportunity to join MTN as a legal and regulatory advisor. I have been with MTN for 10 years and left MTN mid-February this year.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Suma, I just want to find out, were you part of the team that advised MTN to write that letter of objection to ICASA in terms of the interconnection rate, but also advising MTN wrongly, because the laws say that you cannot put conditions to the regulator. The letter that was written to ICASA from MTN and the other operators was a letter which, when we discussed in the committee here, Advocate De Lange advised that we have to look at who were the legal advisors to MTN who gave them that wrong advice, to put that conditions to ICASA in terms of the regulating of the interconnection rate. Were you part of that team?
Honourable Member of Parliament, I wasn't part of that team, because when I was at MTN, you know, I was in the regulatory department. I was one of the senior legal and regulatory advisors, so you'd have your areas of focus. So then interconnection wasn't an area of my focus for me. It had its own people. So to answer your question, Honourable MP, I wasn't part of that team. Did that answer your question?
No, the reason I'm asking is, it says that you were dealing with tariffs. MTN cannot charge any tariff without lodging and getting an approval from the regulator. It is my responsibility to lodge such tariffs and negotiate with the regulator for approval. That is what it's saying in your CV.
Okay, if I may answer this, like I say, Honourable MP, you would have areas allocated, yes. You would have in some other institutions or operators where you have whoever looks after interconnection also do tariffs. With MTN, I looked after tariffs, but there was somebody else looking after interconnection. So we separated interconnection from tariff. Not that I wouldn't know what would be happening in interconnection. I would know what is happening there so that it feeds into my area, which is tariff lodgements and approvals and products and services as well, that type of thing.
I'm very happy you weren't part of that team. It would have been a big black mark against your name. So now you've got a big positive mark against your name. You must tell that team they're very bad advisors. Have you read the Section 6 of the Act? It's the whole clause that deals with disqualification. The things that you're not allowed to be to become a councillor, which you're applying for. Have you read it? Do you comply with all those? Or so I'd rather say you don't fall into any of the disqualifications.
There's no reason for me to be disqualified under those sections, Honourable Member of Parliament.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you two specifically, because it's very important that we know. It says if you or your family member has a direct or indirect financial interest in the electronic communications, postal and broadcasting industry. Do you or your family fall in that category?
No, Honourable MP.
And then the second one is you or your business partner or associate holds an office in or with or is employed by any person or body within those limitations that I've just excluded. You don't have anyone like that?
No, Honourable MP.
All right. Can you tell me... We know that you have legal qualifications, and we know you've worked in the industry for a while. What would you say are your strongest qualifications that we should take in consideration? Not just qualifications and characteristics. We should take into consideration for you for this post.
Honourable Member of Parliament, I just stated that, you know, my experience in the industry, both having worked for the regulator when it was first started, and then having been with in the private sector or the industry for 10 years. That aside, but I'm just thinking that for a counselor or for anyone to fill a vacancy at ICASA, one needs to understand the mandate of ICASA as enunciated in the pieces of legislation, you know, the ECA, the ICASA Act, the PFMA, and then as well the bigger picture, because you see, ICASA doesn't operate in isolation. It is a regulator that has got the DOC as a shareholder, so you need to work very closely with the DOC as well. If you look at the Act, if you look at Section 3, which gives the minister the powers to set up policy and also issue directives, and as well it causes powers to make regulations. You can't separate the two. You have to work together in that system. So, you know, the bigger mandate of the government to deliver on certain areas, I mean, the key ones that were also set out at the Polokwane conference in 2008, you know, health, education, creation of jobs, prevention of crime, or measures to prevent crime, and as well rural development. So you need somebody that understands the mandate of ICASA at the legislation level, and then as well somebody that understands the bigger mandate then at government level. And for me, Chairperson, I'm sorry, through which of course a member of parliament, I believe at this stage I am more than ready to get in and assist the government to deliver on the on that mandate.
I don't know you. I must make a decision about you, whether you're right for the position. So I need to know you, your characteristics. What is it that you feel makes you suitable for this post? I'm not disclaiming the other things you said, that's fine, that's all. But I'm trying to find out about you as a person, because that's not said in the CV.
Honorable Member of Parliament, if you're asking about that, my strength, of course, first of all, I believe in people must be genuine and be upfront about. I'm a genuine and upfront person. I believe in working with a team or working in a team, and consult and listen. Very important to listen and understand what the issues are before one can act. So I'm the person that I'm very genuine. I'm loyal. I want to understand what the issues are. And before I act, so I don't like to act on hearsay. I want to listen. I want to hear from the people, from whoever. I mean, from where the issues are coming from, so directly, and then make a decision. I don't and as well, you know, I like to bring people on board. I like to bring people on board, and for me, what is very critical, you know, which is why I say I am more than ready to serve in this position, is that, you know, I have been yearning to plow back into the communities out there, the masses that have made it possible for some of us to be where we are today, you know. So I just believe that it's an opportunity to plow back, you know, take care of the youth, take care of the people with disabilities out there, and the women overall. I don't know if that's enough, Member of Parliament.
You, in this job, it seems to me there are huge pressures on councillors in ICASA. Huge pressures specifically from the industry, because what decisions you take affects that industry. And obviously in the broader political scene, there's also pressure to get things done, move in the right direction, and so on. Explain to me how you will operate to be able to not be unduly affected by pressures, but make your decisions on proper information before you?
It's very important, Honorable Member of Parliament, that a person understand their mandate first. If you understand your mandate and understand what is needed out there by the masses, of course, I don't see why there should be any type of pressure that gets you detracted from what the mandate is. For me, I fully understand the mandate of ICASA, as I said, enunciated in different pieces of legislation, and the bigger picture at the DOC level. So it shouldn't be about me. It should be what is needed out there. What is it that we need to deliver on? So the focus shouldn't be on me per se as a person. It shouldn't be personal egos or anything like that. People must focus on the mandate and deliver on the mandate. Yes, political pressures, industry pressure. As well, if you talk about industry pressure, there will be industry pressure where you detract. If you're going to be acting out of your mandate, as enunciated in the Act, that's where, you will get that type of pressure. But if you act within the Act, if you act within the laws, you shouldn't have that type of problem. That's just what I'm thinking.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I was just wondering whether Ms. Tsebe here or Mrs. Tsebe is related to Susan. And I think you have got a sister here, but she's not here, my dear. You seem to have an insight of what has been happening in ICASA. What I would like to know is maybe the areas that we have seen for this 10 years that you are telling us about, the areas that weaken ICASA, and what contribution would you have, if you happen to be appointed as a chairperson? And also you have explained the relationship between ICASA as a regulator and the minister, but I want you to tell me whether you do understand the relationship of the regulator ICASA with the portfolio of committee in Parliament, committee that is having a responsibility of oversight over entities of communication, and what relationship do you think should make things to work smoothly?
Honourable Member of Parliament, one should be very careful not to, want to start attacking or criticising people, because you see, one is not in their shoes. But I like what you said in the end, that, having been in the industry for 10 years, what are the areas that, if I've got an opportunity to come in, I'll focus on. So, it's two things. Decisions from by ICASA, they take a while to decide, even on an application, on a numbering application. So, an operator would lodge an application for additional numbers. I mean, the numbers are a national resource. So, you have to get allocations from ICASA. You just don't go using any number that you think fit. You have to apply for numbers from ICASA as the people looking after that national resource. It takes forever for ICASA to respond or to make a decision on whether they want to allocate you more numbers or not. I mean, when I say it takes forever, it can take even more than a year. You apply, you wait for the whole year for numbers to come through from ICASA, if they do come through. That's number one. Number two, spectrum applications as well. It takes forever for ICASA to make a decision whether they want to allocate or whether to make a decision on an application. I don't understand what the issues are because, you know, these two things that I've just stated are guided by the regulations in place to say how they should go about those. So, you know, if I got in, those are the things that I would be wanting to focus on, that, you know, you don't sit on an application. You get an application, you make up your mind on an application and inform the operator so that, you know, they can, if of course you're not allocating any more numbers or you can't allocate spectrum, they know and then they can see other alternatives. Or if they can give you further information that can get you to give more numbers or more spectrum, if any, of course, then, you know, so in essence, you need to engage and inform the industry. You don't sit on applications for that long. As well, the Electronic Communications Act was promulgated in 2005. So one would say, look, 2005 and then into 2006. 2006, then you want to see implementation, you know, the administration of this act. So you would have expected the regulator to prioritize regulations. And maybe they did. I'm just, you know, as an outsider here, somebody who was in the industry for 10 years, that you want to prioritize. There are regulations that you would have wanted to act on very swiftly because, you know, you hear the government start talking about certain things. You know, the cost of communications in South Africa is too high. The cost of communications being too high in South Africa was spoken about like years back. I mean, even in the days of when, in the days of former President Thabo Mbeki, those were the days that the government started talking about the cost of doing telecommunications and or communications being high. Yeah. So when you have an ECA being promulgated, you want to prioritize those regulations that will deliver on that. So, you know, it's surprising that the government at some point through the DOC then had to take a step of now exercising political power to have mobile termination rates cut, and then also then followed by this regulation that ICASA just worked on. I'm just saying, you know, you want to privatize and work on the ones that are needed urgently to deliver on the mandate of the government as well. So those are mainly the areas that I have identified that we want to act swiftly on. Yes, that one as well. If I was to put like an organogram, I would say, you know, you have PPCC, you have the minister or the DOC, and then you have the regulator or the industry. So, you know, the PPC has got that government mandate. I mean, the things that I just listed that I said were also that came from the Limpopo conference. I mean, you know, health, education, job creation, crime prevention, services in rural areas or underserviced areas. Those, I mean, you would want to see ICASA enable the industry out there to deliver on those things, because you see, at the end of the day, you are the ones that are answerable to the president and the masses out there. I mean, politically, of course, on delivery of those services. So for me, it's that you will definitely, as a regulator, also want to consult and get guidance from PPC as well. So you can't work in isolation.
Thanks, Chair. I think my story has covered some of my questions, but I would like also to probe it further. uh,
because it's possible that during your term in, with MTN, you develop certain projects and certain programs. But when you apply to ICASA, then you find that ICASA is delaying you as an operator. But now, the best strategy for you to go to ICASA and try to fast track those things and make sure that your project or your programs or your vision is being realized, because ICASA is taking a long time. Even though I disagree with you, because we don't know what guides ICASA in order for them to take a decision. Maybe in terms of the operator, it's a long time, but in terms of the processes within ICASA, maybe it's a shorter time compared to other regulators. But my question, Honourable Member Delange asked you about your character. You said you are a genuine person, a loyal person, and an honest person. Can you be genuine and loyal and honest with me? Is it possible for a person to build a house and turn around and destroy the very same house? Is it possible? You want to answer that? why I'm asking that? Because the responsibility of ICASA is to regulate the industry. The very industry that you were trying to pursue certain programs and certain projects within the industry. And now, if you get employed or appointed to ICASA, you will then expect it there to regulate the very same programs and the project and the vision that you created and developed while you were with the MTA. That's why I'm asking this. Is it possible for a person, if that person is a genuine person and that person is an honest person and that person is a loyal person, to turn around and destroy or apply some break to the programs that has developed I think that's my concern. I'm worried, and with your answer in terms of the ICASA, in terms of the delay and things like that, and your involvement with MTN and ICASA, I'm a little bit worried. That's why I'm asking this question.
Honourable Member of Parliament, when I worked for MTN, I delivered diligently on my mandate, you know, as a regulatory advisor, because you see, a regulatory department in an operator, you want to see it as a quasi operator, so you're like a mini ICASA in an operator, mini ICASA in MTN. So what you do is you advise the business on the laws that are coming, that are going to affect the business, and where the business now needs to make decisions, do they still go with the strategies that they would have adopted, or do they need to change it given the developments at the regulatory or at government. So, you know, when I worked for MTN, I delivered diligently. I monitored the upcoming laws. I advised the business. Whether they took my advice or not is another thing. But appearing here and showing an interest to go and work for ICASA, it should tell the honourable members of Parliament that ethically, you don't go into the regulator and want to serve the interests of your former employee, especially an operator like that. I mean, you will see it if it was to happen, I'm sure. You know, but it's just something that I'm not even looking at. I served my term with MTN, which ended, and now I am more than ready to serve the regulator. And I will be I will be very objective to the issues, and you know, more biased towards serving the masses out there. It's very important that you know, I emphasize that, you know, I'll be very biased towards you know, serving the masses out there. Of course, the objectives as set out in section 2 of the ECA.
I want to follow up. You know, you mentioned that you were at, I mean, part of the regulatory and sort of a mini INCASA inside MTN. But did you advise MTN when they did not comply with their 3G license condition? They're still not complying with that. Was it not your duty then to say to MTN, but you've got your, this is the conditions of your 3G license. When are we going to complete and completely comply with the conditions? That's my one question. I know a couple of people that have worked for MTN, and MTN has had this share scheme for employees. Did they not allocate any shares to you in terms of that employee share scheme, and if they did, what happened to those? And maybe lastly, will you be earning, is the salary of a counselor more than what you were earning in the private sector, or is it less?
Okay. 3G license obligations, I wasn't directly involved, it didn't fall under my areas of focus. Honourable Member of Parliament. If you look at my CV, you will see the areas that I focused on. But, you know, whenever we got to talk about issues around 3G obligations, my understanding was that it was an industry thing, and then also there were other departments involved in that. So if any frustrations, my understanding, or frustrations in terms of delivering on those obligations, is that it was not from the operator side. So in a sense, it wasn't from MTN side, but it was on the other side. Is it the 5 million cents that we're talking about, I think? Is the 5 million cents that MTN had to discharge? I think. Is that what you're talking about?
There are two things. When it comes to the 3G license, there's the issue of the Naledi school and all of those other things. And for people living with disability access, that is part of the license conditions which they did not comply with. And then when MTN, I think it was about 4 years ago or so, when they gave shares to the employees of MTN, they've allocated shares to all the employees as part of an empowerment scheme. And my question is, did they allocate to you also some of the employee shares scheme shares? And if so, what are you going to do about those shares now if it was allocated to you?
Okay, let me just finish answering your question on 3G license obligations. Like I say, that, you know, my understanding was that the frustration on delivery of those obligations was on the other side. So in a sense, operators or the industry was ready to deliver, but they were just not. There was no proper cooperation with the other side. I don't want to talk further on that.
Which is the other side?
For instance, the part. Maybe I shouldn't talk to this much chairperson because it wasn't my area, but at some point I remember the discussions were around the Department of Education having to identify schools or give them a list of schools, and it wasn't forthcoming, that type of thing. But let me not talk further on that, because honestly it didn't fall within my area of responsibility. And then let me go on to your next question about the share allocation schemes. Back in the years, I think it was 2003, MTN worked on the board shares for the staff members. There they created a trust called Alpine Trust for those shares. So they allocated depending on what level an employee is, you get a number of shares. And then when the trust dissolved sometime last year, the shares vested. So you could decide. So once they vest, you can deal with the shares as like any other. Investor would do. So in a sense, like a person who buys from the JSC and then they just decide how they want to deal with it. So you got that status that you could deal with them that way. So in a sense, what I'm saying is, if MTN was to declare a moratorium on a trading of shares, those shares wouldn't be impacted on, because then MTN didn't have control on those shares anymore. So you trade like any other normal person at the JSC. That's number one. Then there's another one that they have for, it used to be for everyone, but then they decided that it will only apply to senior management and executives. Yes, as having been a senior manager there, I was allocated shares in terms of that scheme as well. When I left MTN in February, it was a voluntary retrenchment, so I took a package. So when you take a package, you have those shares, then you have got 6 months to deal with those shares. So I knew the process of selling those shares, so that if I get an opportunity to come in, I wouldn't have those shares anymore.
No, it is just when, I think it was Advocate Langer who put the question.
Yes.
Ms. Soma did not mention that.
You see, the issue of this, if you have any financial interest in any electronic communications, both in broadcasting industry, in our understanding that would include shares, if you own any shares in any company, etc. Earlier on you said that you are fully compliant, you have no financial interest, etc. Now you're saying that you're in the process of disposing of those shares. That's fine. I mean, that's something that we will just note. And maybe it wasn't too clear early on. Okay, any further questions? Velma?
Thank you, Chairperson. Not really a question, but just a question regarding the checklist for us as a committee and secretary. I see that you've not given the ID here. I just want to know from the committee secretary section, did we receive a copy of the applicant's ID? Thank you.
See, what we have handed out to members is what we have received. So if the ID number was not on the list and it's not ticked off there as having been received, then we don't have it.
Sir, are you a Zimbabwean? Okay, are you a Nigerian? Because that will be an immediate disqualification. We can't assume these things.
Sir President, in terms of my ID book, I am 100% South African.
And it's a valid, not a fraudulent document?
No, Sir President. if the secretary doesn't have, then... I will definitely send a copy of my, or I'll leave a copy of my ID book.
Okay. I might have missed it earlier on. What are you doing at the moment? Because you've resigned from MTN.
Right now I'm doing nothing. I'm unemployed.
Thank you very much. Advocate Langer?
Really small point. I've heard of youth leagues, but I've never heard of the NCAW youth league. Just for my enlightenment, what is that?
Well, that was a long time ago. That was like a long, long time ago. Actually, it's so long that it's a long time ago that I'd have to remind myself about. It was a youth league of what was it? I honestly forgot, but I don't think it's got anything. I don't think it impacts on the business of today on the role of
parliament. Now you don't know what it is. All right.
Right. If there are no further questions, then Ms. Somo, thank you very much for your time. And then we'll... What time are you flying back today? Okay, so have a safe journey home, and thanks very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of Parliament, for affording me this opportunity.
Thank you, then. Just take us through your CV, highlights of your career, etc. And maybe tell us why you think you are a worthy candidate for this particular position of a councillor at ICASA, and then members will fire some questions that you have for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. honorable members of the committee, I really appreciate you having given me time to this opportunity to come and brief you and to take questions from yourself. I believe you have copies of my CV in front of you. I unfortunately do not have a copy. I'll have to just take it off from the head. But what I'll try to do really is rather than go into the CV itself, I think I'll more like to probably put the flesh into what may not be there on the CV. So I put proper perspective into it. I, as you can see on the CV, I qualified as a physicist and an engineer. I did a master's in electronics. In the CV, it probably says electrical engineering. That's how the institution has put it. But my specialization was in electronics when I did that at Michigan State. And you can probably see I've done other courses, like I did an MA in curriculum and instruction, and I have subsequently also done a Master of Science degree, also in petroleum geophysics. Effectively, I think that reflects of me as being somebody not basically who works within a particular box. I am quite versatile. If there's something I have to do, or if there's an area I have to investigate or go into, I will not hesitate to go into it and try to understand exactly what happens in there and work it out. I've worked within several portfolios, mainly within the telecommunications arena and also within the defense sector, where I basically provided services to different entities. ICASA being in the telecom arena has been of very, very much interest to me. I believe it is at the center of what I can call national development basically from the telecommunications and IT arena. There's a lot of things that one can be critical about with ICASA, and I believe that actually that one can add value on and assist directed properly towards the societal development of the country as it is. The issues that range from, let's say, your interconnect contamination rates, which have been dealt with at the moment, and which I'm actually very grateful to this community, to this committee for having actually dealt with that, and the ministry for having raised that issue. Although my personal feeling is that it has not gone far enough. I think the 69 cents that we're talking of at the moment, I mean, from my perspective, is still very high. The issues around that one can look at around, for instance, issues of network coverage, which, if properly regulated, can actually also foster and contribute towards the lowering of the subscriber fees. There's issues of around, for instance, quality of service. which I personally believe if ICASA could properly address, they could it would really contribute towards not only just the issue of the reduction of fees, but also in terms of the getting good services. I mean, as you may, members of this committee may well be aware, when I'm talking about issues of quality of service, for instance, you look, there's a group of people currently who are working at getting what they call a class action lawsuit against one of the network providers. And I personally, looking from the outside, feel that it's an indictment against ICASA that such an action could be taking place, because at two levels, in fact, because at the one level, ICASA should have cannot, if it was monitoring the quality of service as it should have been doing, you would not have such developments taking place. At another level, it's a question of, you find that then ICASA probably may not have properly, is not properly well known out there, which is an indictment against it also, in that people should know, the society should know that the first port of call should actually be ICASA if they have complaints around quality of service. So, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, there's a number of issues one can look at where one within ICASA that one can contribute towards. But for me, if I could summarize where one could actually add value in this thing, it's a question of we want, or rather, when you, for instance, read the, let's say you look at the ICASA Act or you look at the ECA, whenever regulation is mentioned, it's actually most of the time said regulating in the public interest. So you would want to have an ICASA that is actually regulating in the public interest. And if one looks at, for instance, the issues of tariffing and all those things, you would want the tariffs to be affordable to everybody. You would want, I've already mentioned issues, for instance, of network coverage, I think, although albeit briefly, but you would want coverage to actually extend even to the remotest part of the country. So in brief, Mr. Chair, I think that does introduce me, that does introduce what I am about and what I personally believe I can contribute towards the communications authority, at least. And I am ready to actually take whatever questions there could be to clarify some of the issues and to clarify my CV.
Look at Delanga.
Thank you and welcome. See, obviously, young man, 61,
yes,
and have a wide range of skills and so on. But I find a little bit of a gap in your CV. It seems your last employment was in 2004, and it seems you got a degree in 2008.
Yes.
Haven't you worked in the last 6 years? Very lucky if you haven't.
I actually haven't. I've been unfortunate enough not to have worked. But what it's been is it's been more like I've characterized it at times as being on sabbatical or on semi-retirement or finding myself. But it is true that for the past few years I have actually not been gainfully employed. I took time off. And I was in KZN, and in the process, I mean, things like the opportunity to study further came, and I did do that degree during the time. But I was effectively at this time, I mean, I was, for the past few years, it's true, that's how it's been.
Why would you then want to start working again? If I could not work for 6 years, I would keep on not working. What has driven you to now start becoming enthusiastic about working out of retirement?
I had taken time off to, as I say, to whether I call it sabbatical or to find myself, and basically that's what I've done, and or recharging, maybe that would be a better way to probably put it, and I believe I've been recharged and I can come back and contribute much more.
Have you do you know the contents of Section 6 of the Act, the disqualifications to become a councillor?
I haven't through them yet.
Now, I'm assuming that you've applied because none of these apply.
I accepted the nomination, and I did look at those elements. And of particular importance, there is one that does apply to me. I think it was F or something like that. It does apply to me. However, subsection 2 takes the position that did not disqualify me from actually being nominated and going through the process. The subsection or the spirit of the Act, as I understand it, is that although that is a disqualification factor, if at appointment that has been that has been redone. I'm not sure what was the proper word, but
yeah.
if that has been fixed, then the process can continue.
What are the interests that disqualify you at this stage? Sorry, just to say you're
yes.
reading it correctly, the part you've read, subsection 2. But what is the specific qualification?
The specific disqualification at the moment. The specific disqualification at the moment is an indirect interest in an operator. As it is.
Which one?
Chelsea. Yes.
You have shares there.
I do. Yes.
And any other ties, work there, or membership, or your family?
I have
interest in the industry.
None.
And so what are you saying? If you're one of the people that are nominated and you're going to get the job,
yes.
you will then divest yourself of those shares?
I will divest myself of
because you won't be able to be appointed if you don't?
Absolutely.
And that's the only financial interest you or your family have in the communication industry?
It's the only one in the communication industry.
And the next one doesn't apply, that you have a business partner or an associate that's also involved in the industry?
It's
the shares.
It's the shares. And
okay.
It will be, yeah.
All right. What specific characteristics do you have as a person that you feel equips you to be considered for this appointment as a counselor?
When I first learned of this call for application, I was called by a friend I've known for many years. He saw it first, and what he effectively said to me was that, okay, you know, therefore there's this call for nominations. It's looking at somebody who is committed to fairness. It's looking at somebody who is committed to the protection of expressions of interest, freedom of expression. And then he went through what it's looking for, and he said to me, I think this fits you. And knowing your involvement within the telecommunications industry, I would like to actually nominate you to this position. So I said, okay, let me consider it for some time. I did consider it for some time. That's when I actually came across the disqualification criteria and all that. And subsequent to that, I actually said, okay, no, I'll accept the nomination. You can go ahead with it. So I think that in a way gives some of the qualities that I have as he saw it. But from my perspective, also on top of that, I mean, I think
having also been involved in another regulatory environment, puts me in a position whereby I am quite familiar with regulatory environment. So it would not be such a new venture coming into a regulatory environment. Although I don't have a legal background, I fully understand the concepts involved in regulations. Coming from the technical area that I come from makes me suitable enough to actually be involved in ICASA. The background I have in telecommunications, I think it suitably puts me in the council.
Just on a personal note, I see you were in Samafco in 87.
Yes, I worked in Samafco in 87, but prior to that, in fact, I left the country before I actually matriculated. So I was in Samafco earlier, that's where I actually, I did O-levels there. And then from there, I then went to university. Subsequent to that, I came back to Samafco, and then I taught at Samafco.
Now, my interest is that I was there in 87, so maybe I saw you there.
It could be, yes, it could be. Yes.
Chairperson, I just want to understand in terms of your academic record and qualifications, what is the South African equivalent of Master of Science? You've got Master of Science Geophysics, and then you've got Master of Science Electrical Engineering, Master of Science Physics. So it's a master's in a specific subject. Or to just give us, to understand the American grading, you know, what do you say is equivalent in South Africa for those masters?
Typically what one would do is you do a four-year degree, which would be a bachelor's degree. You then have a BS, which normally we would call a BSc honors, that would be the list. And then beyond that, you have an option to directly go into a PhD degree. Alternatively, you can go into a master's degree. And then you run through a master's program. It would take you from a year to however long it takes you to complete it. So you do your master's degree. I think it's similar to the South African master's degree. The difference in this particular case is that you have an option to either do your master's degree through research or through coursework. That would normally be the difference. So if you do it through coursework, you do master's level courses, which are courses that are above the courses that you would have done at the bachelor's degree level. And then having done that, you can probably have a project towards the end that you work at. It's not a full-fledged thesis like somebody who goes on a full master's degree doing a thesis. Mm-hmm. You have a particular project that you concentrate on, and then you do that, and then you, depending on how the university, the faculty evaluates you, and then you get the degree.
So it's a master's degree without a thesis? Then my second question, Chairperson, is on you know, the allegations of the involvement of Futuristic Business Solution in the infamous arms deal. The allegations that Futuristic Business negotiated a success fee with one of the German frigate companies. And I see you also, you know, you were also responsible for the acquisition of equity stake in ADS. So, and you left there in 2004. Are you still familiar with the challenges or the charges against a Futuristic Business at the time? And can you inform us whether Futuristic Business has been cleared now? I'm just asking because But I see that you left in 2004 already.
Okay, just a matter of clarification there. There were no charges instituted against Futuristic Business Solutions at all. There were allegations that were made against the company, as well as against certain individuals who were in the company. And I happen to be one of those people whose allegations were made against me. The matter was fully investigated, as you know, through the SCOPA process. It was investigated by the different entities. And there were never any charges that were instituted against any of us or the company as it is. There were absolutely no charges. They were found to be baseless. I mean, some of the charges against, for instance, for me, is if I wouldn't have liked to go into that, but I'm just saying the basis, for instance, on which it was alleged that I did whatever was that I was the son-in-law, for instance, to the former minister, Joe Moses, which is absolutely not true. And so there were allegations then of nepotism and all that, but completely unfounded. So that's the situation. But I must say, I mean, it was not easy for a person like me when there's allegations coming left and right and you don't know where they emanate from, and there's absolutely no substance to them. It was not very easy.
Maybe just to correct you, Mr. Malloy, yes, you correct all these government agencies, the Auditor General, Public Protector, all of them investigated these allegations. And they actually found that there was nothing wrong in terms, which is still disputed today, in terms of the primary contract, where the problem started and that was where government was involved. The problem was really with the secondary contractors. And I'm raising it, you know, because, you know, while you are in front of us, give you an opportunity to explain. So that we don't afterwards, when you are not here, to defend yourself. And so I'm happy with your answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good day, Mr. Malloy.
Good day.
Mr. Malloy, in your sentence in the beginning, you mentioned a couple of troubled areas in ICASA, not regulated properly, take a long time to make decisions, etc., etc. From your point of view, you are not in the engine room of ICASA. How do you see the problems, if any, at ICASA? What's the reason? Incapacity? How do you sum it up?
Thank you, sir. And correctly put that I'm not in the engine room of ICASA. But from an outside perspective, one sees a number of challenges that are facing ICASA. If we can go back onto the matter of in the interconnect fees, for instance, I think for me the issue was a matter of approach. You see, ICASA as a regulator is supposed to have a position, a regulatory position on the interconnect fees. They were supposed to have had that. However, they took the approach that no, they would rather the networks negotiate amongst themselves, and then they basically come and rubber stamp whatever the negotiations were, the agreement was from the negotiations. Now, if it was in another industry, you probably would call it collusion, because really here it's if the negotiation, if I can put it this way, if the negotiation is between a supplier and the subscriber, then you can take that approach. However, in this particular case, you've got a negotiation between two suppliers, and the subscriber is not
represented in this particular case. So they can agree among themselves on whatever fee they agree on. And in this particular case, then we know that we had this 125 cents, which was a burden on our shoulders for many years. And as I say today again, I still believe that 69 cents is also still too high. But the issue is, on that matter, it was the approach that was taken by ICASA that would be a problem. The issue of capacity may also be playing a role. They may not have, I'm not quite familiar with whether they have sufficient personnel to actually do this thing, but there's also issues of human resource training that should be looked at. From my perspective, I mean, we know that the president has just come up with a big delegation, for instance, from the with a big victory on the for South Africa to join BRIC. And I'm saying, if you look at the victories within countries, like the BRIC countries, I mean, you look at the victories that have been won by India on this same issue, whereby your interconnect rates are in the region of about 15 cents. I'm saying, why, if we have to train our people, we need to actually at times train them in areas like that, which face similar problems than us. In capacity building, if there is a problem with capacity, we need to be able to train people, but train them in relevant markets also. Don't just take them to other areas where they will not face similar, or they will not gain experience that would be within similar a similar environment as we are having within the country. So I would say, for me, in terms of the challenges, not being inside the NCC, I think there's matters of approach, there's issues of capacity building, as you're saying, probably there's a problem of capacity, and then there's not proper training and all that. That is relevant to the environment that they'll be facing.
Follow up, Chairperson. Do you think, Mr. Malloy, you as an individual going into an organization can make a difference, or are you going to run against a brick wall and be swallowed by the big organization and sort of lose your fire and your individualism and everything and your thoughts?
I was looking at, I think it's Section 5 of the ICASA Act that looks at the responsibilities of the authority as well as those of the chairman. It puts succinctly the responsibilities of the chairman and the council. It's just about, if I'm not mistaken, it's just about 3 points. But the most important one that's put there is the one of leadership. That if one has to go in there, you should be able to lead the authority, be able to have a vision in terms of where you want to go, know exactly what you want to do. You should not be, the industry should not run roughshod over you. You should be able to lead this industry and this thing. And you determine for the industry what has to happen. Because really, indeed, I've mentioned some of the few things I mentioned, for instance, the issue of, let's say, of network coverage. For me, it's a very, very, very important thing in that, you know, you here in Cape Town, or in Gauteng, anywhere, Durban, you get very, very good coverage. But what about the person that is somewhere deep in the Northern Cape, I mean, who doesn't get coverage? And that person may require, or that community may actually require coverage to engender development of that community. Now, if the regulator does not force the network operators to cover that area, they are not going to do it out of themselves. And the reason they don't do it is they'll tell you that base station there will not make money, and which is not very true. which is not very true, because the way they work it, the model that the industry uses is they will look, it's flawed in a number of ways. They look at a particular base station and say, okay, that base station will not make money, therefore we'll not put it. However, the issue is that base station, they have a threshold and they're saying we're not going to get sufficient money out of this thing. That is the first problem with it. The base station may actually make money. However, they may reject it because it doesn't make sufficient money. Now, ICASA has to force them to cover that area. The other point one can look at is, looking at it from outside, I'm saying to myself, even if we have a situation whereby a particular base station to cover a particular community would not may not make money, let's say, the approach is wrong in that each individual network operator looks at this matter, at this community, at this base station, isolated from all the others. Because if we've got how many operators now? I think we've got about 5 licenses. There's Cell C, there's Vodacom, there's MTN, now the Telkom and the SNO. Now, if all 5 of them, if they looked at it, they say that this community, they may find that this community is not a 5 base station community. It may just require 1 base station. But if they learn to cooperate and have infrastructure sharing, the cost of that base station for each network operator may be actually 20% of what it would have, what what they have calculated it to be. But the value of that base station to that community is immeasurable. So that's the way I look at it, that the regulator has to look at some of these things and enforce some of these approaches. Because I believe once, for instance, if you can force it on a rural, let us say in the Northern Cape, on this rural community, the network operators would learn to see that they can be infrastructure sharing, and they can even bring it to the urban area. But the ultimate effect of it, besides the issue of social development for that area, is that it will actually bring the cost of calls down. And for me, that is the important aspect.
What managerial experience do you have? Two, and what regulated experience do you have? And the third question is, what's your understanding of independence? This is the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa. What's your understanding of that independence?
I'll start with the last question, Mr. Chair. My understanding or my interpretation of independence is where in the Act it says it's subject to the law and the Constitution only. That's my understanding of it. It is subject to the law and to the Constitution. It is not subject to interference of any sort. That's independence. You are, or the authority is independent. It's able to assert its position in the public interest, regardless of outside interference or outside positions, if one can put it that way, outside forces. That's how I understand it. In terms of managerial experience, it's as reflected in my curriculum vitae. I have worked through a number of positions, and I have held different portfolios at the managerial level, at an executive level, as well as at board level, basically above having responsibility over the executive managers of whatever the entity would be.
I think the last response of Mr.
Molai.
I nearly said Baloi again. Have touched on my question, because what I wanted to know is what would be his reaction if he was appointed as a chairperson, as a councillor? What would be his relationship with the executive at ICASA? There are some problems that we have picked up when we do our oversight, so that's the reason why I wanted to know. And partly, since you understand independence in the way you have explained yourself here, what would be your attitude towards the accountability to some of the, actually to the institution in Parliament, of the committee that is in Parliament that deals with communication, when it does its oversight role, and what would be your understandings, you know, since you have explained to us what you think of independence in terms of the powers that are bestowed to the minister in terms of policy making, and how would you relate with the two? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. I think it assists me, in fact, in clarifying what I meant in terms of independence being subject to the law and to the constitution. I hope I did not give an impression that one then is outside of the ambit of the institution. In fact, the performance management system that has to be put in place, whereby whoever is a counselor is actually managed, if I can put it that way, by this house. That is how it is, and that annually there has got to be reports and an evaluation of a counselor by this house, and one fully understands that, one is appreciative of that, because the issue is you cannot be appointed. And having been appointed, then you go, and do your own thing, which is outside what this house requires. That's my understanding of it, that you are subject to, I don't want to contradict myself here. It says it is independent in the Act, it says subject to the law and to the listing. However, that has to be understood in line with the performance management system, that much as you are independent, that independence is that way, you are subject to the performance management system, and that's how it is. I hope I answer your question.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then I thank you very much for your time and for your patience. I know you've been waiting for some time. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the committee.
Pronouncing correctly? Good. Welcome to you. Is this the first time you're coming to Parliament? First time in your life? You're coming for an interview. Alright, so welcome to Parliament. In front of you are members of the Portfolio Committee on Communication. They come from different political parties. We'll speak to you for about half an hour or so. What we'd like you to do is just talk to us about your CV, take us through the highlights of your career, and why you think you'll be a worthy candidate as a counselor on ICASA. So what's your experience and what skills do you bring to bear on this post? And then members will ask questions, and I can predict the kinds of questions. They ask all sorts of questions. So we'll take them as they come. Over to you then.
Okay, firstly, my name is Patricia Patilau. First of all, my name is Linda Delbach. I come from Clarksdorp. I've applied for the position because I think I can make a difference. I don't know a lot about ICASA itself regarding the telecommunication system or the Broadcasting System Act, but what I do know is, what I've read, is that I think from a communication perspective that we can really make a difference. I think if I'm sitting here, I can say that for myself, I'm here as an independent candidate. I'm not here for anybody else or representing anybody else. Regarding my CV, what would you like to know? I've been in communication my whole life. I've studied at Potchefstroom University. I've moved over to the University of the Free State. And I've recently, about 4 years ago, started again at Potchefstroom University and finished. I started my career within the town council, and then thereafter I moved over to Eskom, and I'm still in Eskom. It's been a few years now. Even though I've been working for Eskom, I've been working for a lot of external companies as well. Basically, just to get experience on a different level, I've also been dealing with some organizations and helping with some community organizations. And this is basically by choice. Anything specific you would like to know?
Thank you very much. Very brief. Thank you, Mayor. Any questions? Mr. Fenerbahce?
Good day. Are you staying in Clarksdorp voluntarily?
I'm in Clarksdorp voluntarily.
That is.
I can truly and honestly say I've been offered a few positions in Johannesburg, and every time when I thought about it, I just said, you know what, it's about quality of life for me, and it's not about the money. It is.
I don't know.
Nothing will get me to move to Johannesburg.
No offense, please. You said you don't know a lot of ICASA, you know, what's going on in the engine room of ICASA. And coming in from the outside as a rookie, as a newcomer, how do you see your role? Because there's a lot of decisions that have to be made in ICASA, very urgent. Do you think with your background in communications, you will fit in easily and know how things is working in ICASA?
What I saw is on what I've read about ICASA and what I followed throughout the past years was my interpretation was that the stakeholder relations is not not built very well. What I would say in essence is that I think from a kind of communication perspective is you can do a lot more because you can work with, you can build relationships on either side. I know they were speaking about role clarity and problems with the communication problems between ICASA, the board itself, and the CEO. And I think a lot of these issues can be addressed if there's mutual relationships that's being built. When we were driving here from the airport, one of the candidates said to me that you will need a chairman that comes over very harshly to deal with the CEO that comes over strongly. And I tend to disagree with that because my viewpoint is just that anybody can fight, but to build mutual relationships, take an effort, and to build a bridge, to talk to somebody, and to get a common departure point, and to get mutual ground, that takes courage and that takes an effort. And I think a lot of the problems can be addressed if people go and sit and talk to each other. My other perception of ICASA was a lot of the work is reactive, and this is interpretations, like I say. If I think of what happened last year, the Reputational Institute had a problem with ICASA where they said that ICASA didn't act when there was a problem with the SABC, with the broadcasting of the news, where they said the news department was not independent, and there was no action taken by ICASA. And I don't think it was because ICASA didn't want to get involved. I just don't think there was a document on the table telling ICASA to get involved. And I think if there was a proactive action taken, it would have been detected. And I think action would have been taken. on an issue like this. And I think the same applies to the Vodacom issue that happened. I think reading from the newspapers, it was said that COSATU intervened and told ICASA to get involved and to stop Vodacom from selling shares. And they just said that ICASA didn't take action. And I just think there was no proactivity from ICASA. I just think they waited for somebody to tell them to act. And I think if a lot of stuff is detected earlier, if you've got a strategic, I don't know if they've got a strategic advisory team, but if they can use a team that's, that advises them proactively, a lot of stuff, a lot of the issues can be dealt with much earlier.
From what I sense in your CV, I mean, basically you are a media and public relations communications person. Am I right in saying that? That's really what you do.
Yes.
But this is not a media and PR post. This is a specialist area that looks at, you know, regulatory frameworks,
yeah.
Setting broad policy frameworks and guidelines into operation for industry, very complex industry, and for broadcasting. So what, I mean, do you have any other regulatory experience? One, have you sat on any boards? Because this is technically a board that is being established. As a council, what board experience do you have, and what managerial experience do you have?
Look, if you say what I can contribute, what I saw or how I saw myself in ICASA was basically, if you look at the board members and if you look at the CVs of the people within ICASA, they are very, very knowledgeable and they've got lengthy CVs. And I think if you look at that, it's a network of excellence. And how I saw myself was basically, if you can strengthen, if you can take the strength of this network and basically make sure that there's mutual understanding and make sure that everybody's got the same departure point. So this means basically to ensure that there's mutual agreement, then you can work together and ensure from there on that there's more productivity of work being done. My experiences, I haven't sat on any boards before, but the closest to it what I've got is on the Premier's Communication, on the Provincial Premier's Communication Forum, where we sit about once every 3 months and we decide on provincial strategies to address the communication issues within the Northwest Province. The board was under Cornelius Monama. He resigned, he was moved to another position about a month ago. Basically what happened, there's a consultancy firm that works through all the media clippings and makes sure and then tells us what was the issues that need to be addressed. And then they draft strategies to make sure that we address the issues and give a positive view of the government. And alternatively, but basically just local, it was the, I was sitting on the local ratepayers association board where we negotiated with the council when we felt that there was activities that we did not felt fair towards the citizens of residents staying within Clarksdorp. And then basically it's just my sitting, I was involved in various national campaigns from Eastern side, and I think it's sitting on national committees.
You've read the ICASA Act? Have you read the ICASA Act? Are there any conflicts of interest? Do you have any business interests? Your family, close family members?
No, not at all. No.
So you are fully compliant?
Yes, I am.
And you will not be disqualified in any way?
No.
Good. Any further questions from the members? Thank you, then. No further questions. Thank you very much for your time. Dr. Nubi, welcome to Parliament and Portfolio Committee on Communication. There are members here from different political parties. So, is this your first time to Parliament or have you been here before?
I've been to Parliament at the 13 many times.
Oh, okay, you've been here before, so you are at ease.
Yeah, and at Centec.
I see, okay, okay.
Yes.
All right. So, welcome to you. What we'd like you to do is just talk briefly to your CV.
Okay.
In fact, I see from all the CVs we've received, yours is is limited to 2 pages, if I remember correctly, 2 or 3 pages. A very, very sketchy CV, but you, of course, the oldest of them all. So we'd like you to share your wisdom and experience with us. So you will talk to your CV for 5 or 6 minutes to tell us, you know, your qualifications, your work experience, etc. And then members would put questions to you, and they come as they come. I can't predict what questions come. So over to you then.
Distinguished members of Parliament, Chair, allow me to express my sincere gratitude for you to have me here. I am now at the August of my life. I am very humbled to be brought here and express some of the things that I have done in the past. I do believe that the Rainbow Nation is up and running and vibrant, not just by seeing all of you here coming from different persuasions, gives me hope that we will eventually accomplish our goal. I left South Africa as a young boy at 1960, naive. I was not too politically astute. And I went through the pain and agony of exile life. Went through Tanzania, Congo, and wound up in the U.S. I got an African-American scholarship, and it was part of the Fulbright scholarship, and I pursued my studies. And I must say unequivocally that during my stay in the U.S., my life floated at double level of entendre. On one hand, it was fighting against the oppressive laws of apartheid and playing the role of advocacy to all places, including places like Atlanta, etc. And at the same time, I was schooling. I was highly committed to my school. I got my first degree at Rochester Institute of Technology in General Studies. I then went on to get another degree in library science. At that time, library was defined as library and school of archives. We were in the first group that saw Syracuse moving from library school to information studies. That is when now my interest in information came to being. Because I found that there is a wealth of information that does not just fall in one discipline. It compelled me to be on an interdisciplinary platform. Upon graduating from the library school, I was then attracted to study social science at Maxwell School of Public Administration. At that time, Maxwell School of Public Administration was a very good school, similar to the school at Harvard. I did a master's which required 60 hours of social science credit. Upon graduating from there, I then pursued a PhD, which was interdisciplinary. The main focus was adult education, but it was two-legged. You had to do library and information, and also do social sciences. And I can safely say that I succeeded to go through that degree, and professors who were supervising my PhD were highly distinguished. I had Professor Charters, who is considered the father of lifelong learning. We also had Marta Doza, who has distinguished herself in library science. We also had Dr. Morgan, who was a social scientist. I went through that, and then Rochester Institute hired me as a senior RIT researcher. By the way, at that time, Rochester Institute of Technology, MIT, and other technology institutions were almost at the same parallel line. And Rochester at that time was considered the hub of technology because it headquartered Xerox, and it headquartered Kodak, and it also headquartered Bausch & Lomb. So suffice it to say, I also got used to technology and the whole sociology of technology, the uses of technology and the misusage of technology. That's how I got, you know, interested in that. But after serving a year at RIT, I was then recruited by the World University to go in Puerto Rico to prepare the University of the World University for accreditation. That's where my regulatory interest came, because every course that was offered in that school had to meet the Middle State HIGIS code. For instance, if you are studying English 101, it must be equivalent to Harvard English 101, otherwise it would not be accredited. And I was the liaison person for that institute, traveling from Puerto Rico to Philadelphia. And it also gave me a lot of exposure in the Caribbean region, where I did that. And when I was there, I was then invited by UNESCO, PGI, to go to Africa and help in the formation of information science. Because most of the schools in Africa at that time were defined as library and archive, you know, schools. Information, when you mentioned information, they called you CIA. No, that word was a no-go area. And I was literally lynched in Ghana when I mentioned, because my paper was entitled Some Scenario of Information Science. At the same, they say, "Yo, CIA, whoa," from Africa. But at the end of the conference, everybody said, "No, now we no longer want library and information and archive. Every school must now be information science." So 32 countries after that conference converted from library science and archive to information science. I went back to Puerto Rico, and I was then again later invited to go to Liberia, Ghana, and University of Ibadan to help them set up this information, the concept of information science. Little did I know that one day I will be brought back home. And a certain gentleman came to the U.S. with my sister. I'm sure you know my sister, Sister Bernard Nube. They said, "How come you are in the U.S. while we are, you know, suffering, and you have all this knowledge which you got because of the Rainbow Country? Please come back home and help us." And I went back and packed my little bag and came back to South Africa. I was tenured in the U.S. I worked in the language lab, which has over 130 nationalities, and I was teaching them how to speak English as a second language. And it was highly successful. I got many awards for doing that. And also, I always boast that in Washington, D.C., I didn't go to the wealth. The wealth was brought to me. And that's how the whole system came. When I came in, the Development Bank got me from the U.S. and brought me back. I managed the information department. And I'm proud to say that in that department, I was able to consolidate all the Bantustan information, which was not part of the main South African statistical data. And we played a pivotal role in bringing that together. And I'm sure you are all conversant with the 9-province profile, which defined the demographics of each province. I was instrumental in bringing that about. And equally important, when I was there, I also was assigned to serve in the Comtas team. We were called a gravy train at that time because we had to visit about 17 countries in order to establish what became GCIS. And because I was in the development bank, I was then assigned in that team to establish Chapter 5 of the Comtask, which dealt with what is now known as the MPCC, the Multipurpose Community Center, and it also established the GCIS. So we successfully transformed the communication system in South Africa. And while I was there, I was then appointed to serve as the chairman of CENTEC. And I must say that for the whole year, I wasn't even paid for being the chairman of CENTEC, but I took, time off from DBSA to make this contribution. And from 1998, I served under Jay and also Ivy for almost 8 years, if I'm not mistaken. And during that time, I managed to get AD Little to do a report on CENTEC, what are we going to do with CENTEC. And that AD Little defined CENTEC, the broadband concept, all came out of that. And I also persuaded the country to move from analog system to digital. We even pilot tested how digital system would work. And it was very successful. However, there was no money allocated to roll out, the digital platform. And then around that time, I also served the UNDP Africa Futures Program. With Professor Adedeji and other distinguished leaders of that time. We even launched a book here on Africa Futures, the scenarios which were launched here in Parliament. But for 5 years, I traveled throughout the length and breadth of Africa, quite conversant with their information problems, etc. And around that time, I was also one of the people who went to the plenipotentiary meeting in Malta. And we stayed there for 2 weeks to define how telecommunication through IT's sponsorship, how it should be implemented in our country and in other parts of Africa. And that gave me an enormous experience in the area of informatics. I was also appointed to serve in the board of Arrivia.com, which is now sold to T-Systems. I served there for 4 or 5 years, and by the time they sold Arrivia was one of the 10 most successful IT companies. And I can safely say that in the parastatal field, it was one of the few companies that really showed, success. Yeah. And after that, I was then asked to serve as the chairman of TASIMA, which houses Inatis. You all know how Inatis was in shambles. And as chair, I'm very proud that today, Inatis is one of the most beautiful, intelligent instrument for the country. When police people stop you, when you are driving fast or recklessly, they have to harness that information from, you know, e-natives. And I can safely say that today it is running seamless and it is really a success story. Now, colleagues and my leaders, when I sit here and see this mosaic collectivity of people all sitting here making policies, and the DOC also making policies, I feel that from a regulatory point of view, as your servant, I would be able to serve you well to redefine ICASA. I am not going to destroy ICASA if I'm appointed, because one of the tendencies in this country is that when you start appointed to do something, you forget, you have an amnesia of history. You just want to start there and go. And yet there must be a historical continuity of where ICASA has. One has to do a SWOT analysis and say, where were the strengths, where were the weaknesses, where are the opportunities, and how, what is threatening ICASA. And then after that, you take it from there, then you move forward. And I feel if I am given this opportunity, given my history, as I told you, it would also, from an egotistic standpoint, if I may use that word, it will also round up my career in the area of ICT. But this is secondary. If not, I will just sit down and swing low and swing cherry low.
Yeah.
And I'm also aware of the problem that ICASA is facing, this element of having a chairman always there and also having the CEO. If one is inexperienced in these areas, it can really cause a lot of tension. You know, what is set up by you members of parliament to be an enabling environment becomes a deterrent. But I can safely say that if I am appointed chairman, I will make sure that the councillors work as a faculty. And a faculty does not always manage the university. You know, they leave that to others. They have to be a center of excellence in that school. And I also feel that each person who is in that faculty, if I may use that word, must show leadership in his or her area. That's one. And if we are doing universal service, you know, there must be someone who leads us, and we must decide as a group, you know, on consensus building that this is the way, you know, to go. Yeah. And the other people, CEO, they just give us the administration element, which will not interfere with this, you know, think tank. And we are solely responsible to you in this house and also to the minister in terms of the policies that have been formulated. You cannot formulate policy here and then I just do things that are totally not commensurate where the country must go. So it is for us to use our ingenuity to strengthen what our Rainbow Nation is aspiring to be. Equally important, we must become conversant with the trends that are taking place in the world. We do live in a global village. ITUs must factor in, TRASA must factor in if we are part of the African continent. And I must say that at my age, everybody was a PAC in 1960 when I left this country, because we were young at heart and angry. In my house, there's been a sharp contradiction, because everybody who followed was a member, a defined member of ANC. You see? So when I came back home, I said, no, politics is over for me. My politics is to define and develop this country. And I must say that I did quite well along those lines. And I am pleading with you that if you appoint me, I will continue to make information regulatory element as the main orchestration of my life. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Benavent.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good day, Mr. Mube. It seems to me the shorter the CV, the more interesting the person. may I ask you, sir, is there any country in the world that you didn't visit yet? Just on a lighter note, Mr. Mube, back to ICASA, I'm very glad you mentioned that we're not here to discover the wheel from the beginning and sort of kick everything down to pieces and try to rebuild from scratch. As you look at the situation at this stage at ICASA, we know there are some problems. We've heard this in our communication portfolio committee, but maybe just focus on one or two of the main key problems you see in ICASA, and how will you, as maybe a member of that board, deal with that problem?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Well, your point is highly well taken. ICASA, when it comes to very practical things that we need to regulate, it would be, you know, the broadband, I rate it very highly, because we have very limited, you know, broadband, how it is put to use and who is licensed, and the processes of licensing need to be fully defined, and we as a regulator are highly responsible to make sure that it is understood both by the policy makers this side and also the people that must be used. So we are like an interlinking mechanism. Here we need to devote a lot of our time defining broadband to include any platform capable of transmitting high bandwidth intensive services and application and content. We need to really get into that. There are other 4 points, but I don't want to belabor that. Competition is also something that is key. Promote access to telecommunication service for all our people, that is important. Because if there is no competition, then there is no growth, and we are all often told that ICT is getting to be one of the largest job creation and other skirmishes in our, you know, in our country. And we don't have to look further. Just look at MTN, Vodacom, how it has grown, you know, so much. And also how the payment, you know, that is taking place there for ordinary people, I think it's exorbitant. I was in the U.S. when they unbundled AT, you know, which was a monopoly, and then it moved into that, and it helped to reduce, you know, the price. So that knowledge we need to again do it systemically. I know you have done, you know, the pricing, and it's moving slowly, but it has to be really looked, you know, closely and see how it can be unpacked. Spectrum, you know, ensure that the nation's spectrum is used efficiently and effectively. You know, it's another big concern of ours. And then, of course, media. Develop media rules and policies that achieve statutory, you know, policies, you know, objectives in light of significant changes to our move. We are moving from paper media to electronic media. There is internet element which has come in full swing. I know that internet was in the U.S. first used purely for military activities. You know, but after the East-West Cold War, you know, sufficed, then they opened, you know, internet. We need to look at the sociology of internet and how it can be used for developmental purposes. And these are some of the things that we must look into. Yeah. And you also have public safety, and also, you know, that is a very big concern, especially with the 2010, etc. How are we going to make sure that our children are protected from the misusage of these things? I have also developed a website called devterms.co.za. Please look at it if you have your time, because there I simply highlight key issues in poverty, climate change, etc. DevTerms is devterms.co.za. Yeah. And I started, you know, out of severe boredom to do it, but now it has developed to be a very, very good instrument. When I looked at Google analysis, which I get every other week, now almost 45 countries are looking at this in the world, and I'm very proud of that.
You follow up?
I just want to ask the chairperson, yes. Mr. Mube, do you receive money for every hit on that website?
No. I was born so poor, but so damn loving.
Patricia?
I hope you will forgive me. I know it's wrong for a younger person to ask an elderly what's your age. So I should actually be saying Tata. I see that your age now, and that, you know, you will be appointed for 5 years. What is your secret that you stay so young and bright? And is the 5 years not too long for you? When do you want to retire?
But just look at you, how beautiful you are. They say mine is the same.
But Patricia is 25 at the moment.
Yeah.
She's 25 years old.
Yeah. And age is a state of mind. And it is true that when, at my age, I might be senile, but senility is called Operation Wisdom. Because you no longer have to go into a lot of quantitative elements. You just pull this into wisdom. Yeah. Yeah. And my father died at 102. My mother died at 93.
Doctor, you have read the ICASA Act. Are there any business interests that you have in this sector that will disqualify you from appointment? Because it's a requirement of the law that we check that.
To be quite honest, not at all, not even an iota. If you made me a chair and you didn't pay me a cent, I would still be happy to do this, because it's so vital. All of you here could be running big businesses, etc., because you are expertly qualified. But you are here because you love your country better than anything else. And with me, I guess it is the same clarion call.
Are there any further questions? No questions. No, sorry. Anybody have a question?
Maybe I should say at our age.
A beautiful tour.
I see whenever the doctor refers to women, he uses the word beautiful. No, it's very high for women.
You must always take into cognizance that there's experience. You can see.
Maybe, Chairperson, we must just warn Ikaza and get rid of all the young girls that Ikaza has just said.
If there are no further questions then, Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
And for your patience. You've been waiting for quite some time. The committee obviously will have to deliberate on, you know, all the interviews, etc. And then we only make a recommendation to the National Assembly. We don't make a decision. And from there, it still goes to the minister, and then it comes back to the National Assembly, and then the minister finds their point. So there's a whole process. But thank you very much for your time.
Again, Chair and Honourable Members of Parliament, I must again express my... I'm humbled by this experience. And if you feel I still have strength to serve my country, I will do so. But if you feel I am too old and senile, I will try and find a spider web somewhere and meditate every day. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Was going to go to the House for report on the 11th of May. That's sometime next week, is it? But I want to suggest that we might want to hold that back a bit and just give the study groups time to meet between today and tomorrow or so and to work out how we handle the rest of the process. Because if we are going to be doing, let's say if we decide to do all the interviews by next week, then we could actually report one time to the House. So we don't make any final determination now. We've interviewed 5 people. And if we want to interview another 5 or 8 people, because we have to recommend 6 names to the National Assembly total. There are four vacant posts, so we need to recommend 6 names. So we might want to interview a few more people. And if we can do that by next week, then it gives us an opportunity to report to the House a little bit later in May, and we're done with this process. So if the study groups could consider that, and if that's, you know, maybe we can just phone me tomorrow, so then we don't have to meet tomorrow to finalize 2 names for this particular position. Then we work towards finalizing the list of 6 names, which we then submit to the House. So give it some thought, and that means that we might not meet tomorrow. But then we will have to give some time next week if we decide, because then we'll have to sit as a team to shortlist and those kinds of things. And finally, the committee has to take the decision to invite certain people for interviews. So that's all that I want to put forward for consideration. I don't think we need to take a decision right now. And I'm just signaling that there might be some change to our program then.
I think what we must do is look further through that big stack of paper and identify a couple of other names. Maybe if we come forward with 10 names, and then we can have a meeting like prior to this meeting. Put some names together, shortlist a couple of people,
And then we